we explore the intensive English program at UW-Milwaukee, barriers to fluency, and how English proficiency is this gateway to so much more for Afghan refugees. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Join in on English as a Second Language, what you've encountered, 800-642-1234. Two of the students enrolled in the program fled Kabul during the Taliban government takeover last year. They stayed at Fort McCoy, and we are only using their first names to protect family members still in Afghanistan. Farzana, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you.
Good morning. And Maruk, can you hear me? Welcome to you.
Welcome. Thank you.
Yes, sure. And Brooke Haley here as well, director of UW-Milwaukee's English Language Academy and its intensive English program. Brooke, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having us.
So you've been helping non-native speakers learn English for more than 20 years now. How have you seen the intensive English instruction change people's lives?
That's a great question. I started teaching ESL in the late 90s, early 2000s. And at that time, a lot of my students were actually refugees from Bosnia, former Yugoslavia. So it's interesting and sad, obviously, at the same time to see how just in 20 years, people keep needing to flee their countries and come to the U.S., and they begin their journey here with English classes. And so it's wonderful to have that opportunity to connect with newly arrived immigrants and refugees and the work that I've done.
I'd imagine your program is like a mini United Nations. You must have students from all over.
We do. The intensive English program and the English for Academic Purposes classes, both parts of our English Language Academy at UWM. We have students, from all over. Last semester, I taught a class, and there were students from 7 different countries. So 7 out of 10 students were from somewhere else. We serve a lot of students from East Asia and South Asia, but we also have students from, for example, this semester, Democratic Republic of Congo, Colombia, Sri Lanka, I mean, really, all over the world. It's fantastic. It's the best part of my job.
I wonder, does the learning curve you see for English fluency depend on what your native language is? Or does that ability to learn English really rest more within the individual learning it themselves?
I think it's a little bit of both. When you're learning a language that's closer to English, or you're learning English, and your native language is closer to English, like German or some of the Romance languages, there are a lot of cognates or words that are, really sound the same. So that helps with vocabulary development, I would say. And oftentimes the grammar structures are similar. But when you're learning, English and your native language is Arabic or Chinese or, Korean, the grammar structures are so different. The alphabet is different. So you have more to tackle, I would say. So that is a big part of it. But I do think that a student's, just natural abilities, right? And time they can commit to learning the language, and oftentimes their own academic experiences in their home countries really contribute a lot to how quickly they'll learn English.
We're talking about UW-Milwaukee's efforts to support Afghan refugees through English language instruction. Brooke Haley there directs the university's English Language Academy. And now we're going to turn to students, Farzana and Maruk, students enrolled in the program. Farzana, I would love to ask you, how does it feel to have this opportunity to learn English at UW-Milwaukee?
First of all, good morning, everyone. It is the best experience that I ever have in my life, because it was my dream to study in a university out of my country, especially in the U.S. And I think I live my dreams now.
Hmm. Farzana, what's been the hardest part about learning English?
Well, for me, the pronunciations. Yeah, it is the most, it is the hardest part.
Maruka, let's hear about your experience so far. How does it feel to be learning English?
Well, I'm enjoying learning the another language, and here I'm enjoying with the teachers and the students from all over the world, from different countries. I'm learning everything new from them, so it's great.
How much time do you spend to studying? How much time do you put to studying English?
Well, we have different classes, and during the day, like we have three or four classes, and so beside that, so I'm just putting my 2 hour or 3 hour learning English.
How is it going? Do you find that you struggle sometimes, or can it be frustrating?
Well, it is good, but sometimes, as Farzana said, some pronunciations are different because back in my country, we studied English, but with different pronunciation. Most of our teachers were studied at like British, but they whenever they came and they taught us, so we have different pronunciation for some words. We learn from them. So in here, the American pronunciation is different. So sometimes I have struggling with pronunciation some words.
Brooke, how is that with pronunciations and your students coming from with different bits and pieces of English with them that has been taught to them in their native countries?
Well, English is really a global language. So, there's no one right way to pronounce words oftentimes because, as the student said, people speak English in, South Asia and all over the world. And so they have their own accents that they bring with them. And that's wonderful. I think it just makes the language more diverse and interesting. I understand that when students are here learning in the United States, they would like to have an American accent. So, we do the best to help them with that, but embrace a variety of accents, right? Because it is truly a world language with lots of accents that come with it. The girls are in a speaking listening class, and the speaking listening teachers work on pronunciation as part of their presentations that they prepare. So they get lots of feedback that way.
Are these like the speaking and listening classes at in person?
Yeah, all of our classes are in person this semester. So the students in our intensive English program, where Mahrukh and Farzana are currently studying, they have a reading class and then a writing class, speaking listening class, and then kind of a all skills integrated skills class that's kind of content based. So they get the full gamut 4 days a week, and then Fridays are reserved for field trips or events or meetings and things like that.
We are talking about UW-Milwaukee's English Intensive Program. Enrolled 9 Afghan refugees this year. Brooke Haley directs the program, talking with students Farzana and Maruk with us, using first names only for helping to protect family in Afghanistan. Join in with your questions about English and university and professional life, how you learn to speak and write it. 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation now about UW-Milwaukee's English Language Academy and its intensive English program, where students pay to learn English before embarking on a university education or their professional life. Join in on English language learning, how to support refugees who settle in Wisconsin, 800-642-1234. The Academy's director, Brooke Haley, stays with us. We also have students in the intensive English program, Farzana and Maruk, who we are using their first names. They fled Kabul when the Taliban seized control of Afghanistan's government last year. And Farzana, Rosanna, I want to turn to you now. As you traveled from Kabul to Fort McCoy, what challenges did you face in this journey?
First of all, I was feeling very lonely because I was not with my family, and it was the first time that I was separated from them. It was very hard, especially for my mom because she is sick. And the other sides, when we traveled here, we didn't know that we are coming here. Mm-hmm. And all the way that we came till Spain, we went to Saudi Arabia and Spain, and we were 1 week on the way, and we didn't know we are gonna go.
Mm-hmm.
And what is the what's the last location that we are gonna stay there? So it was very hard to not to know where you gonna go. Yeah.
Mm. Are you able to talk with family members still in Afghanistan?
Yes, I'm in touch with them. We are talking virtually, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Through social media.
What do you tell them?
Well, I don't know. We just mm-hmm. talk.
You just talk, yes. Marouk, what happened as you left Afghanistan? What was that like for you?
Well, first, it was not easy to leave my country and especially my family. But I knew that it was a good chance to save myself and my dreams. Whenever we left there, we went to Saudi Arabia, and then after one day we went to Spain, and we spent one day in Spain. So after that, we came to United States, and especially in Fort McCoy. So as a young woman living in an army base without any family member, and also without any belonging, so it is difficult because it is a different country here. So with new culture and new language, I faced like many challenges, including mostly loneliness, but at least I knew that I was safe, and I said, it's fine. It's a new journey, so I will start again and everything will be fine.
Hmm. Do you feel hopeful, Marouk?
Yeah, I'm feeling hopeful always.
Hmm. So, Brooke, I want to bring you back in here. Refugees who enrolled may be undergraduate students. Can you explain a little bit how the students are able to take these classes and be able to pay for them?
Sure. So our intensive English program, as you said in the intro, is designed to help support students who need to improve their English before beginning university level coursework. And when we heard, we got an email from kind of a consortium of intensive English programs, a representative from one of those programs sent an email out to the group explaining that there's a group of students at Fort McCoy from the Asian University for Women, and they're looking for university homes for the students. He saw an article in the Chronicle of Higher Ed. And so our assistant director of the Intensive English Program shared the email with me, and we had just been talking at a meeting about, you know, what could we try to do, if anything, to help support Afghan refugees as they're, you know, coming in. And so I shared the request with the vice provost, and he forwarded on to the provost and then the chancellor. You know, the request was to try and provide a 5-year scholarship for these young women, a year of English if they needed a year, and then 4 years of undergrad study. And it just wasn't possible for UWM at this time. And we're an access university that serves a lot of students with high needs, you know, plus with enrollment decreases, you know, due to COVID and other things. The university wasn't in a position to offer such a complete scholarship. And so I was feeling a little, you know, just obviously disappointed. And I was talking to another colleague about it, and Mary, and she is a member of Eastbrook Church, which is a local church that does a lot of work with immigrants and refugees in Milwaukee and has for, you know, decades. And she said, you know what, our church has been looking for a way to support Afghan refugees. And I think they'd be interested in trying to do something to help this group of girls. And 10 minutes later, we got the okay from the missions pastor at Eastbrook Church. And we started, you know, organizing. The church pledged to pay for their intensive English studies for the spring and summer semesters, and then to fundraise to pay for their undergraduate studies until the girls can qualify to apply for FAFSA and get some, you know, hopefully grants to continue that undergraduate tuition support. But right now, as humanitarian parolees, their temporary status doesn't allow them to do that. So Eastbrook has committed to, and Eastbrook and actually we organized UWM's Intensive English Program or English Language Academy, and Eastbrook created an organization called the Afghan Student Partnership of Milwaukee, ASPOM. And that's kind of our fundraising group to get money to help pay their undergrad tuition. We're committed to paying it as long as we need to, until they can qualify for federal aid.
That's a remarkable story.
So that I just want to also add that that covers kind of the tuition and the fees. But a huge part of that too is the host families that they've been placed with. These are all families from Eastbrook who invited these girls into their homes and into their families really for as long as they need to be there. So that also has made this be able to happen. They're in loving homes with families that, you know, support them and give them advice and, you know, are there for them when they need them. So I think that combination, this partnership between a public university and a local church, I think is a beautiful model for supporting, you know, refugees as they come into Wisconsin.
Talking with Brooke Haley, who leads the UW-Milwaukee's English Language Academy, and hearing from two students enrolled in the program, Farzana and Marouk, you can join in 800-642-1234. Let's take a call now. Mark is joining us from Appleton. Mark, hi. What's on your mind?
Hi, good morning. I'm so enjoying your program, and I wanted to thank Farzana and Marouk for taking the time and effort to learn English so that we can hear them tell us their story and we can listen. My mom was involved in the ESL program. It was one of the best volunteer experience she ever had. So I hear my mom as Brooke talks about the program. My question for you is, and I try to emulate my mom's je ne sais quoi, if you will. My question is, since you have a wonderful classroom full of students learning English, do the students have an opportunity to teach the other members of the class a little bit about their language? And I'll hang up and listen to your answer.
Mark, thank you so much. Brooke, what is that sharing like?
Oh, that's an interesting question. In our speaking and listening classes, for example, students often do presentations about various topics. So students will often in those presentations talk about their cultures and their backgrounds. And I have seen students share a little language lesson. It's not, you know, part of our formalized instruction, but it is, you know, there are lots of opportunities as friendships develop and as, you know, parts of those more formalized presentations for students to do that. It's a great idea, but I think that cultural sharing is really just, that happens every day, all day with our students, and that's really a beautiful thing.
Marouk, how does it feel for you to be with your classmates and learning English?
Well, it's great, but sometimes I help. I can understand some of our my classmates because their pronunciation is different. Like most of our Korean classmates, it's sometimes difficult for me to understand them, but I'm learning from them.
Farzana, do you learn from your classmates as well?
Sure, everyone is learning from different cultures. And so, yeah.
Well, thank you all so much for joining us. Brooke Haley, director of UW-Milwaukee's English Language Academy and its intensive English program. Farzana and Maruk, Afghan refugees, fled Kabul during the Taliban takeover last year. Both enrolled in the program, plan to attend as undergrads this fall. We use their first names only as a precaution for their loved ones still in Afghanistan. Find a link to the program, WPR.org/mornings. News update is next on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about the Ojibwe practice of spearfishing.
Spearfishing is a tradition practiced every spring by Ojibwe tribes in northern Wisconsin. It's a practice that's been passed on for generations, and it's part of tribal rights to hunt, fish, and gather on lands ceded to the U.S. government under federal treaties reached nearly 200 years ago. Earlier this month, WPR's Daniel Kading tagged along with a group from the Lac des Flambeaux Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa, as they taught tribal youth the time-honored tradition of spearfishing.
Lac des Flambeaux Tribal President John Johnson Sr. says the tradition of spearfishing is at the heart of the tribe's name.
When the French came here, they seen our people out in canoes with torch lights, and that's why they call it Lake of the Torches here in Lac des Flambeaux or Wiswaugeni.
That's the Ojibwe word for the tribe, which Johnson says means Lake of the Fire. For hundreds of years, tribal members harvested fish by torchlight in birch bark canoes at night. As the sun sets over Little Trout Lake near Lac des Flambeaux, Johnson and other tribal members are preparing to take tribal youth out to spearfish for walleye, or oga. Before they head out, young kids take part in a drum ceremony. They sing several songs, including one for tobacco, or asema. Johnson tells the kids to place tobacco in the water. Ojibwe language and cultural teacher Wayne Valier explains Mishipishu, a great water panther, protects the water on behalf of the Anishinaabe people.
When he sees the Anishinaabe putting their tobacco in the water, that makes them happy and pleasant. And what that'll do for us is that'll calm the lake for us. So it'll make it easy for the Anishinaabe to harvest and see the fish.
The group loads up their boats with large tin buckets and aluminum spears around 12 to 16 feet long. Johnson is heading out with his 11-year-old grandson, Ganebic Johnson. Ganebic says he usually goes out with his granddad, who's taught him to share what they harvest to feed their community.
It's important to Native people, and we do this to provide our families, and we just hope we don't get harassed.
Just over 30 years ago, hundreds of people harassed tribal spearfishers at boat landings in northern Wisconsin. They hurled rocks and racist remarks after a federal judge upheld tribal treaty rights to hunt, fish, and gather on off-reservation lands. While there's no sign of trouble on this night, Johnson says not all people know or understand their rights.
They don't realize that we utilize the woods for our food, the lakes for food, and we try to be respectful for it. And we try to save some for the next generation.
Out on the water, Johnson slows the boat as he heads toward a spot near the shoreline where walleye are spawning. His grandson and grandnephew, Liam Armstrong, wear a helmet with a headlamp attached. Johnson says they shine the light from side to side on the shallow water.
The eyes glow. That's all you got to do is catch a glimpse.
It's not long before his grandson, Ganebic, spears their first walleye of the night.
Right there, Ganebic.
Oh, good one, buddy.
9-year-old Liam eagerly waits his turn.
That's what I wanted to do when I grow up. Last year, I got 5 walleyes, and it's fun doing this.
Tribal members take kids out in four boats that are each allowed to spear 25 fish per permit. They count the walleye and measure them to comply with tribal regulations when they return to shore. Kids then sit around the fire and swap stories about how many fish they speared. 11-year-old Ryan Mendez speared six walleye. He says it's cool that they're keeping this tradition alive.
It's a real great thing. I really appreciate it. I like it. I think it's cool that we can all go out in a boat and have fun time, spear some walleyes, and maybe see a big monster coming your way.
The hope is that these kids will learn and practice their culture, language, and traditions so they can pass that on to future generations.
WPR's Danielle Kading brought us that story on spearfishing. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
And now to the work of the nonprofit called Aid Access that provides abortion medication by mail in the U.S. and around the world. Through telemedicine, the organization provides abortion pills to women in countries with barriers to abortion health care. It was launched 4 years ago by a Dutch physician. Join in on at-home abortions, on care in a post-Roe v. Wade America, 800-642-1234. Christy Pitney is an advanced practice midwife with the Washington, D.C.-based Forward Midwifery. She is affiliated with Aid Access. Christy, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Good morning. So with the Supreme Court seemingly poised to overturn the landmark Roe in the coming weeks, what are you doing to prepare for this potential new reality and this sea change for reproductive rights?
Well, our organization is uniquely positioned that we have clinicians both within the United States and Dr. Gompertz, who started it, and she's based out of Austria. And so because of that, she's able to continue to prescribe the medication abortion pills into all 50 states, even if there are state-level restrictions. So the main thing that we've been doing is hiring some extra staff. We have a help desk that helps us to do the administrative work, and they're a huge piece of our puzzle. And then we've been in discussions with the manufacturers, and they all feel confident that we have a good supply of the medications. So we're going to be able to continue to offer services into all 50 states.
Can you walk us through how the services work here in the U.S.? Can you kind of walk us through that model?
Yeah, absolutely. So anyone who needs the abortion pills by mail can go to aidaccess.org and fill out a consultation, which is, it's inclusive, but it's not time consuming. So it asks questions like, what was the first day of your last menstrual period? How many surgeries have you had? Things like that. And then our help desk team will review it, do the administrative work, make sure that we have the proper mailing address, any follow-up non-clinical questions. And then they send it to the appropriate clinician. So for Wisconsin, that would be Dr. Gompertz. She would review the case and then write an e-prescription to a mail order pharmacy that's based in India that we have worked with for a long time, for the entire time that Aid Access has been running, as well as before that with some of her other organizations. And then that pharmacy will mail the prescription to the folks, to whichever address they have requested.
So I'm wondering then, according to the Guttmacher Institute, 19 states, including Wisconsin, require having a clinician physically present to provide a medication abortion. Wouldn't that mean that these states don't allow abortion by telehealth, don't allow abortion pills by mail?
Yeah, absolutely. So a clinician from within those states would not be able to offer these services. And even someone inside the United States, but not in Wisconsin, for example, wouldn't be able to prescribe across state lines as the laws are right now. However, because Dr. Gompertz is based out of Austria, there's no state level jurisdiction to stop her from offering these services. And she's following all of her medical and legal requirements from where she's based out of.
From what I understand, mifepristone is extremely restricted in many countries. The other drug, misoprostol, as well. Why do these medications route through India?
So Dr. Gompertz has been connected with that pharmacy in India for a very long time, but we started using it because we know that the medications are often manufactured in India, and then they go through a lengthy vetting process and they're high quality medications. And so that is a big part of why we have used the pharmacy in India. We are also looking into finding pharmacies perhaps in Mexico or Canada that would reduce our shipping time so that the medications could reach people faster.
Can you explain from your healthcare background how these medications work when they're taken?
Yeah, absolutely. So like you said, there's two medications, mifepristone, which blocks progesterone, a hormone that's required to continue a pregnancy. And that's the first one that's taken. And then about 24 to 48 hours later, the person takes misoprostol. And that is a medication that causes uterine cramping and bleeding. And so that's the one that really pushes out the pregnancy, any pregnancy tissue. And someone will have heavy bleeding on the day of taking that medication. And everyone's different, but you can have bleeding that's much milder for anywhere from 1 to 4 weeks after taking that medication.
There's also cramping as well with the medication?
Yes, exactly. So it's very hard to counsel exactly what someone will expect because every body is different and then every pregnancy is different. And it depends on how far along someone is as well. But I tend to tell my patients that they can expect something between a very, very heavy, strong period, or if they've had labor before, perhaps like early labor pains. So it's not a comfortable experience, but that's that means that the medications are working.
What is the cost for these services?
So for states that are restricted, such as Wisconsin, where the medications are going through Dr. Gompertz and through India, the requested cost is about $110. And then in states where we do have U.S. clinicians, it's $150. But for any of the states, we offer the medication on a pay what you can sliding scale model. So even if someone can't afford that full cost, we'll make sure that they can still access our services.
Is that sustainable for your organization? Will that model work for the foreseeable future?
Yes, it has been for this entire time. And we are looking at ways to secure funding. We actually have RAP, WRRAP is a national abortion fund here in the United States. And so they are funding the states where we do have U.S. clinicians, and we're still working to find ways to help support Dr. Gompertz, but she's been doing this for a very long time, and it has been sustainable. We'll just have to continue to evaluate after the Supreme Court decision, because we saw an increase in demand after the draft decision was leaked, and we anticipate seeing an even higher increase after that decision's official.
Christy Pitney, midwife affiliated with the nonprofit Aid Access, which provides abortion services in all 50 states, talking about access to abortion medication as the U.S. Supreme Court appears poised to overturn protections under the landmark ruling Roe versus Wade. Join in on telehealth abortions on medication-based abortions, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Christy Pitney here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's pick up our discussion on access to abortion services in Wisconsin in light of the U.S. Supreme Court appearing ready to overturn Roe. The nonprofit called Access Aid sends abortion medications through the mail using a telemedicine model we've been talking about. Its founder, Dr. Rebecca Gompertz, told Ms. Magazine earlier this year that they've helped over 30,000 people with abortion services since 2018. Join in 800-642-1234. Christy Pitney with the nonprofit Aid Access stays with us for about 9 more minutes. I want to pick up with something you said there. I'm wondering how and if you feel the effects of policy change, because that may be an indicator of what's to come. Like when Texas and its law took effect September 1st, banning all abortions basically after 6-7 weeks of pregnancy. Did that change in Texas law cause a change at Aid Access and seeing more patients from Texas? Could you put that two and two together?
Yes, absolutely. We did see an increase right around September 1st. And we actually saw an increase from across the nation. It wasn't just localized to Texas. And then pretty quickly, our requests in other states went back down to the normal rate. But the ones in Texas have stayed elevated and understandably so with the 6-week restrictions. And then, yes, when we saw or heard about the draft decision, we had an increased demand there as well. I think part of that has to do with more awareness. So more people are talking about Aid Access and other telehealth medication abortion models. And then partly with fear of not being able to access medications in the near future. And then also starting around September 1st with the SB8 decision in Texas, we started offering what's called advanced provision of medication abortions, which is where someone does not have to be pregnant right now and can request a prescription to have on hand for the future. And so we saw a huge increase in requests for that after the draft decision was leaked.
Let's take a call now. Laura is with us from Manitowoc. Laura, hi. What is on your mind?
Hi, I'd just like to know for people that are listening, what are the things that we can do in terms of time, in terms of donations, in terms of getting the word out? How specifically, if you had a wish list of things people could accomplish for you, please tell us what we can do to help.
Laura, thanks. Christy, go ahead.
Yeah, that's amazing. Thank you so much. So I think that the most important things people can be doing right now are donating to local abortion funds and practical support organizations, because those are the folks who are helping people to either travel out of state if needed or requested, or to access their pills online. And so you can go to the National Network of Abortion Funds website, or to a website that is called Apiary, APIARY.org. And that one's for the practical support. So those are the people offering transportation, hotel rooms, things like that. And then of course, looking at the legislation in your state and seeing how you can lobby, vote, encourage legislative changes is hugely important right now as well.
Has medication ever been blocked in the mail coming to a patient in the U.S.?
We have not had that issue at all. Of course, there are sometimes problems with the mail. Things get lost or delivered to the wrong address, and then we will, as quickly as possible, send out a new package. But we have not had any known issues of people withholding the mail or opening someone else's mail.
And typically, how long does it take for a patient to get that prescription from when they first contact you?
Yeah, so currently we have U.S. clinicians in 21 states. And in those states, which are listed out on our website, the medications take about 2 to 3 days to arrive because they're shipping from within the United States. But then in any of those restricted states right now, there's 29 that Dr. Gompertz is serving. Because it's coming from India, it has to go through customs, obviously it just takes longer. So that's about 2 to 3 weeks to get those medications.
And what if someone needs follow-up care after taking the medications? What happens there?
Yeah, great question. So people can always email us and we tell them that we will respond within 12 hours. Generally, it's faster than that. And that's often good enough for a lot of basic follow-up questions. But we also know that that is not fast enough for some more urgent things. And so there is a hotline, the Miscarriage and Abortion Hotline, that is a clinician-run hotline where I volunteer on there as well. We answer calls and text messages for people with medical questions during an at-home miscarriage or abortion. So that is a really great place that I would recommend people turn to before going in for in-person care, such as an emergency room. And then the absolute last step would be to go to an urgent care or an emergency room. But it's extremely rare that that would need to happen.
I'm interested in what comes up on the hotline. As you work the hotline, what are some things that you encounter?
So we do get a lot of questions of where can I get pills online? And so then we redirect them to places such as plancpills.org, which is a directory for how to access the pills. And then also the medical questions are a whole range of things. Can I use a tampon after my medication abortion? When can I take a bath? Is my bleeding too heavy? Am I not bleeding enough? I'm having diarrhea. Is that normal? So just a wide range of things. But what we have found is that these medications are really very easy to take and people understand how to take them. And so we don't get a lot of callers to the hotline who have either missed a step or messed something up with the process. Most folks are very capable of doing this at home on their own.
Do you think there is a preference for telemedicine abortions because, you know, as you say there, people can stay in the privacy of their own home?
So I think there's a lot of factors there. So doing telehealth, you don't have to have transportation. You don't have to arrange childcare, take off time from work, walk past protesters. It's often cheaper. So there's all of those things. But I also think that folks are just being kind of pressured or pigeonholed into choosing telehealth abortion because of the political climate. And so that's really unfortunate. I think in an ideal world, people would be able to choose between community-based care, going to a clinic, not having that stigma, or choosing telehealth. I would rather they have any and all of the options.
We have a question here from Luann in Madison called and was wondering how long the process takes after taking the second pill. Luann says they've heard it takes about 6 to 8 hours.
That's a great question. Yes. Yeah, so the bleeding generally starts, bleeding and cramping, 1 to 6 hours after taking that second medication. And then that's a good window, 6 to 8 hours. I generally advise it could be 6 to 12 hours. And that's the really heavy bleeding and cramping, the really uncomfortable part of it. And then, as I mentioned, lighter bleeding for anywhere from 1 to 4 weeks after that time.
Very quickly, because we're out of time, why did you get involved with Aid Access? What brought you to it?
Yeah, thank you. At the time, I was living in a semi-rural area in California where people in my area would have to drive at least an hour to get an abortion. And as I sort of alluded to before, people in that area, they did not have reliable transportation. They were working 6 or 7 days a week, language barriers, immigration barriers. And so I was trying to find a way to offer access to the people in my community. But I was working at a federally qualified health center, which means that because of the Hyde Amendment, I couldn't offer those services in my clinic. Hmm. And so that's how I got connected with Dr. Gompertz and Aid Access.
Christy, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Christy Pitney is an advanced practice midwife affiliated with a provider called Aid Access that works to provide abortion services to all 50 states. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.